When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, hello everyone, welcome back to New Books Network. This is your host, Shuwan. Today, I feel very happy to invite Dr. Kathy Buckley to join us to talk about her fantastic book, Caritas. So, Dr. Buckley, I want to invite you to introduce yourself to our audience.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm Katie Barclay. I currently work at Macquarie University in Sydney, although a lot of the work that I guess this project came from came when I worked at the University of Adelaide, where I was the Deputy Director of the Australian Research Council Centre for the History of Emotions. And so what I do is I study how emotions are culturally and socially constructed and how they are different in different societies and across languages. And I think about what difference that makes to, I guess, how we do emotions and the kind of, I guess, decisions that we make about our emotional life. And my work, Caritas, this book, is one of the books that kind of fits into that project of work.
Thank you so much, Professor Buckley. So for the next question, I'm wondering why you're interested in studying the fantastic topic, the history of Caritas.
Yeah, well, my PhD was on marriage in Scotland amongst the social elite. So this was the aristocrats, the very wealthy at the top. And I had always been interested in going back and thinking about the peasants, the people at the bottom of the social ladder, and thinking about what was their emotional life like. And so this kind of was a project to think about, I guess, how peasants, the emotional world of peasants in 18th century Scotland. But one of the things that happens in the 18th century in the European context is that there is this thing called the culture of sensibility, where people put an awful lot of emphasis on emotions as an expression of the self. So people, men, weep publicly with no shame because they see this as showing that they have a certain level of civilization. And one of my questions was, you know, can we think about the culture of sensibility as having any relevance for peasants, right? People who are at the bottom of the social ladder, or is this just something for your elites and your middle classes who are reading novels and thinking about these things? So I don't think I found the culture of sensibility amongst peasants, but I wanted to think about what kind of cultures of emotion drove behaviour. And in doing that, I started to think about Caritas, neighbourly love, the sort of way that emotions acted as an ethic that shaped how people should behave towards each other. And so this kind of interest, I guess, in Caritas was about thinking about a culture of emotions for that social group.
Thanks so much. Now let's turn to your book. So the first question, I want to invite you to talk about Scottish Church teaching on Caritas.
Yeah. So in Scotland, we have what's called the Kirk or the Church of Scotland, who had, a very strong discipline on moral and social life in the period that I study, and perhaps especially for the very poor who did not have the money or power to escape the discipline of the church. But I think more than that, the people genuinely did believe in the church's tenets that they were part of. And so one of the interesting things about all Christianity, really, and actually there are similar principles in Islam and other faiths, is the concept of charity or neighbourly love, the idea that you should feel love towards the people in your community, the people around you, particularly the people who share your faith, and that should guide you at your behaviour towards them. And so if you love your neighbour, you would not be violent towards them, you would not steal from them, you would behave in ways that are respectful and kind, and you would help them out if they needed support, you'd give them charity as we would understand it today when they were poor or suffering. And this is something that the church teaches in Scotland, but also actually Christian churches teach this more generally. And they teach it through things like the catechism, where people have a series of lessons where they learn how to behave. And the really interesting thing about the Scottish church's catechism is that it has a very strong emphasis on this as a discipline of emotions, about how you feel. So it's not just a behaviour, it's something internal. It's about making sure you feel in the right ways and that your behaviour in some ways will be guided by that feeling. But also it's accompanied by a lot of, I'd say, disciplines of the body, like modesty and not dancing and not engaging in libidinous or kind of naughty behaviours. And so there's this kind of, I guess, moral control that the church teaches Scottish people, which guides their everyday behaviours. And then the first chapter, I think a lot about that in relation to marriage and how it guides the appropriate, I guess, gender roles within married life.
Thanks so much for your answer. For the next question, I'm wondering about how young people were socialized into the emotional ethics of their society and how this sociable self was produced.
Yeah, it's a great question. So this is an issue I explore in my book. So if we think about the church is teaching you how to do emotional life, we all also want to think about how you learn those lessons. And I suggest that Scottish people learn these lessons from when they are very small children and all the way through their childhood and adolescence, through the kinds of, I guess, rules and guidelines and socialisation practices that they see around them. And so there's a strong emphasis in Scottish society on loving children and showing them love and caring for them, and not just for your own, although you might preference your own, but for the other children in your community, that you look out for them, that you offer care to them. And so children are actively shown what love and care looks like. And that kind of promotes, I guess, a particular kind of understanding of what neighbourly love should look like as a practice. And I think this is kind of important in the history of emotions because it teaches us about the ways that our emotional lives aren't just natural or instinctual or come from nowhere, but actually are guided by a set of rules that you can actually see people being socialized into from when they're very young.
Thanks so much for your answer again. So for a third question, I'm going to invite you to talk about why are people inculcated in the emotional ethics of characters persist in a behavior that were both immoral and that fractured their relationship with this community.
But why that happened? I think it's because, I mean, it's a church teaching and because it's something they believe in. But I guess an idea that I want to explore in my book is the concept of emotional ethics. So we often, I guess, we thought about emotions as things we feel, but we've also thought about them in the field as a disciplinary regime. So ways of restricting behaviour or restricting, so we might encourage men to express anger but tell women to repress anger, or we might so we kind of create rules around what's normative expression of emotion, and that's the sort of discipline on the human and on their expression. But we can also think about the ways that our expression of emotion becomes involved in our ethics, and so often the decisions and judgments that we make every day rely I guess on that gut feeling, and then every day and in that moment, often the gut feeling is how you actually drive your decision. You might later go and reflect on it and realize it was a bad decision, or you might train yourself to think in different ways. But the kind of thing I was trying interested in is those kind of those drivers that through that socialization practice that happens to us as children to sort of guide our behavior. And the way, if you're taught to love as a kind of ethic, as a behavior, the gut instinct you should feel is to love your neighbor. And of course, people fail in that all the time. And that failure, though, is actually part of this story and something that communities recognize and make space for because they understand that we are human and sinful and so therefore are not perfect. And so there's kind of an interesting way that there's a space for failure, but also to think about that, about the way that we can act aspirationally in our emotional life. We hope to be loving, but we don't always practice it. And so to think about emotions as a sort of an ethics that shapes our behaviour, but also in like ethics to something that doesn't always work. And so I kind of think that people are being kind of socialised into these emotional ethical practices because this is the way that Scottish society, I guess, valued human behaviour, and they wanted people to behave in certain kinds of ways. And so they're kind of creating this culture for themselves.
Thanks so much again. So for the first question today, I'm wondering about how a self formed in the environment where privacy was act of will rather than the result of material conditions.
So can you repeat that again?
I mean, how the self formed community in the environment where Privacy is the act of will rather than a result.
Yeah. So one of the really interesting parts of this community of neighborly love is around how they discipline each other. And this is about observation of good and bad behaviors and reward and punishment in some important ways. And these are small villages of Scotland at this time. I mean, it's urbanizing quite rapidly, actually, in the 18th century. But a lot of people are coming from small villages. They are used to high levels of oversight from their neighbors, people who know what everybody else's business is, and they know what they're up to. And one of the things that you have to do as a good Christian is you have to look after not only your own morals, but the morals of everyone else around you. Because if they are behaving sinfully, then, of course, that affects them. And you don't want them to go to hell. You want them to be brought back into the Christian flock. But also, God is a providential God, and the community behave badly, he might be angry. And so therefore, the community itself needs to kind of keep God happy so that they continue to prosper. And so there are kind of motivations for observing sin. The problem is that living a pure and moral life is actually quite challenging. And so then you have this kind of context, whereas if everyone went around and pointed out every sin that everybody else did, then you would create a situation where you'd have a lot of conflict, very high levels of conflict as people interfered in each other's lives. And so they have this, what they create this kind of sense of privacy, which is, I think, is actually very interesting, is that, and so they choose to ignore what they can ignore, right? So if you know that something's going on, but it's not being thrown in your face and it's behind closed doors and there's no reason to talk about it, then you can just pretend that isn't happening. And so we kind of create this culture of privacy where privacy isn't real in the sense that you have privacy, that people don't know what you're doing, but it is maintained by a decision in the community to ignore certain kinds of problems and only to draw attention to them under certain circumstances. And that's if they become too flagrant or too public. If you do it in the street, for example, you might get in trouble for that. Or just if the kinds of behaviour that you're engaging in, like you murder somebody, becomes so significant that people can't ignore it anymore. And so there's an interesting kind of, situation where in order to maintain a sort of peaceful and harmonious and loving community, you actually have to have quite a high level of tolerance for people's bad behaviour and to not see it. But I think for us, it's kind of interesting to think about privacy as a choice rather than something that it just exists by the fact that you have a closed door or that people don't know about things.
It's much again. So for last question, today, I want to invite you to talk about loneliness and the place of vagrants and the mobile population in a loving community.
Yeah. So in the final chapter of my book, I talk about what happens when you get excluded from the community. Because if you think about your social life from when you are a small child to grow up, to love your neighbour, these are close-knit communities that know what people are doing, then being excluded from the community can then be quite significant. And importantly, in Scotland and other parts of Europe as well, exclusion is a routine practice done for bad behaviour. So if you commit a crime, like a small crime, like you commit a theft, then the local town might banish you from the boundaries of the town, and you're not allowed to enter perhaps for a year or perhaps for 7 years, depending on how bad you've behaved. And obviously, if you live in that town, that can be quite a significant banishment. And so it kind of there is these kind of ritual practices of exclusion that can happen at a serious level when the law does it, but also in local life. So if your sins seem to be too problematic and we can't ignore it anymore, your neighbours might shun you, and the church would encourage them to shun you if they refuse to repent and come back into the Christian fold. And so people who step outside the church in particular are shunned. And so these are kind of forms of exclusion. So in this chapter, I'm interested in loneliness as the experience of being banished. And so I'm interested in thinking about if love is what it means to be part of the community, to feel connected and to feel belonging, then when you are excluded from it, when you're pushed out to the margins or refused a space within the society, then perhaps what you feel is actually a form of loneliness. And so I'm kind of interested in this chapter thinking about vagrants and beggars and other people who live in these kind of margins and how they experience their emotional worlds and what it means to no longer be part of that community and how that feels.
And so so much for your answer again. So now, at the end of our today, I want to directly talk to our audience. So first thing, I want to say I learned lots about emotional history of our character, and I mean, in Scotland, after reading Dr. Buckley's phantasmal. Well, as some of our audience know, I'm not emotional historian, I'm not early modern historian, I'm disability historian. But I still learn a lot. I mean, especially the use of emotional history as a methodology, insightful perspective for my own research. So for our academic audience, no matter what's your field, what's your specialty, interest, I personally highly recommend that you consider buy a copy and read Dr. Buckley's fantastic book. You must learn a lot. You must take a lot of insight for your research after reading the fantastic book. Well, in the meantime, for those non-academic audience, somebody here, you may say, oh, I'm not a historian. I'm not an anthropologist. I'm just want to read something about history. I also highly recommend this book. No matter you are interested in general history of Scotland, you are interested in religious history, or you want to know, oh, that's an emerging, fantastic approach to history we call emotional history, I also recommend you buy a copy and read this fantastic book. So at the end of our talk, I just want to repeat and re-emphasize the title, very short, briefly, but very insightful, interesting title of this book, Caridus. So thanks so much for listening to our episode today. So have a good time.